Welcome to the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Florida will be one of the first states in the nation to have a police force dedicated to elections. This unit will be able to investigate election crime allegations and enforce election laws. This is Governor Ron DeSantis's response to calls for election security. Even though it's the Florida Republican Party that has been under scrutiny for election scandals. We'll have more on the state's new election police force later in the show.
But first, the state's new education commissioner. Miami-Dade Senator Manny Diaz takes over the public education agency as it finds itself the focus of several controversial issues, including rejecting textbooks, speech in classrooms, and banning mask mandates in schools. We spoke with Senator Diaz earlier this week. Senator Diaz, welcome back to Florida Public Radio and congratulations on the nomination as Education Commissioner. What will be your priority as Commissioner?
It's an incredible, exciting opportunity, but I think, you know, number one thing is here, we're facing a teacher shortage. There's an issue with recruitment and retention. Actually, there's an issue across all employment, right? All sectors, and teacher shortages were already coming down the horizon. So that's the big issues because two things that are most important in education in the school is the leadership at the school and the teacher in the classroom. And I think that's going to be one of the challenges we're going to have to step up and face here. And obviously, implementation of this new testing structure that we're going to put in with the progress monitoring that I had the good fortune of sponsoring the bill. So now I'm going to have an opportunity, it looks like, to implement it. So that's something that I look forward to. But again, that those transitions are always a challenge.
On the teaching side, the National Education Association finds that the average teaching salary in Florida is about $51,000, 48th in the nation. Only two states pay less on average. How do you address that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I think, number one, I commend the governor for his leadership on the creation of the first ever in Florida teacher salary allocation, which has never been done, because salaries are really the responsibility of the districts. But he pushed for an investment of about $500 million to get that going. To get the first steps or the starting teachers up to 47.5 initially creates some compression issues with teachers at, you know, different parts of the pay scale. So one of the things we did this year is we invested another $600 million, but we also split that with the flexibility of 50-50 for starting pay and teachers across the scale. And I think we can continue to move in that direction to provide flexibility for teachers for districts to not only recruit teachers, new teachers to the profession, but also retain those veteran teachers that are doing a good job and teaching our children in the classrooms.
Senator Diaz, on the first part, on the starting salary, $47,500 was what was set in legislation a few sessions ago. A recent survey found that a number of school districts in Florida have yet to bring up their starting salaries to that level.
Right. And we expected that was going to take a couple of years because depending on where in the state and what school district it was, they were at different points. And, you know, 47.5 in one part of the state is very different economic purchasing power than in other parts of the state. So you have different district cost differential issues, cost of living issues, and all of that. So it is a work in progress, but I do believe we've made incredible strides in pushing that. And of course, Florida has some advantages that other states don't, you know, our tax structure, no personal income tax, and other things.
On the issue of teacher pay, there is some dollars that are earmarked for teacher bonuses this year for school districts that schools get an A grade or improved grades. Now, the legislature approved some eligibility requirements, including districts where school boards put in place mask requirements earlier this year are ineligible for that funding. Will your department reject those districts if they apply for those teacher bonus funds?
Well, the department has to follow the law, and state statute says that they're not eligible in that. School recognition is a reward. And so for this year, those schools that didn't comply wouldn't be eligible. That's the law. That's what we will follow. We have to follow the law.
And is the department prepared to defend that law if those school districts, including some of the largest in Florida, sue over that eligibility requirement?
Absolutely. The department will be ready to defend the law.
Let me ask about COVID infection rates. They're rising in some places here in Florida. Do school districts have the ability to institute mask requirements for students if school boards decide to bring those back?
No, as a result of the special session, laws were passed where mask requirements cannot be imposed on students in school. The schools are welcome to use other mitigation strategies. Of course, masks are allowed. Their students can wear them if they decide that's the best thing for them, and teachers can wear them if they decide that's the best thing for them. And so I think we're looking away from the mask and looking for more of the other mitigations. Schools have received both federal and state dollars to mitigate using air purification systems, and we've seen that deployed across the state at different schools. Also, you know, having students go outside and be in more open spaces. So they have mitigation strategies they can use, but they cannot impose masks. That's a violation of state law.
If districts do go in that direction, will your department under your leadership seek some kind of penalty?
The department under my leadership will enforce the law, and districts will have to follow the law. And, you know, the department doesn't write the law. The job is to enforce it, and the department will enforce the law depending on any kind of violation on it. So what we're hoping is that, you know, districts continue to use other mitigation strategies, and we keep our kids safe with mitigation strategies that work, and that we keep our students in class learning with their teacher, which is the most important thing.
The agency that you are leading now has been in the news significantly in Florida and in legislation. Let's talk about textbooks here, Senator. Dozens of math textbooks were rejected by the Department of Education for not aligning with state standards, including containing prohibited topics. Will you release examples of all the rejected textbooks? The Department of Education released 4 examples last week. Will you release all the examples?
Well, first of all, this is not a unique situation. There's textbook reviews for adoption every year,
sure.
Different subjects.
Yeah, it's part of the normal process.
And they get rejected all the time for different reasons, not meeting standards. Number two, we have to remember that these are copyrighted materials. And so when a textbook's not adopted, the opportunity goes back to the publisher to make an amendment to meet the requirements of the state standards and what the reviewers are looking for. So they will have that opportunity. And there's not a closed timeline. They can just decide to amend and come back and resubmit. But as far as the copyrighted materials, and I think that's been some of the talk that there's been about wanting the department to release these materials. You can't just release somebody's copyrighted materials.
Well, so how did the department release the 4 examples it did release then?
Well, that's a question. I would have to have the conversations with the legal team to make sure that the department in that instance wouldn't be violating the law, or have the express permission of the publisher. And that may, I'm not up to speed on that exact case of the materials that were released, whether they got permission from the publisher or how it went. But under legal guidance from the legal department of the department, we will make sure that the law is followed and the copyright law is followed and none of that is violated. I understand people wanting to know the why and see the why, but there's more to these things sometimes than meets the eye, and you can't violate copyright law. So that would be a work in progress, and obviously following the guidance of the legal department to make sure that we're in compliance with the law.
The banned subjects that were noted in the announcement from the Department of Education, including critical race theory, social emotional learning in math, and Common Core. Social emotional learning is described as self-awareness, interpersonal skills, soft skills. Why is that banned in Florida in a math textbook?
Well, you have to look at the standards, number one, and then you have to look at the reviewers. These reviewers are people that are teachers that are in the field and look at what's supposed to be in the textbook. I believe what I saw on that is that it referred to that piece as unsolicited. That means it wasn't part of the request for the bid for adoption. What's supposed to be in these textbooks, it has to meet the new standards, the best standards.
Those best standards explicitly state that social-emotional learning is prohibited in math textbooks?
I do not recall the standards saying that, but if it's unsolicited, it's not material that's supposed to be in our book, that can be brought up as a red flag. And again, conversations can be had with the publisher for clarity and to amend any of the submissions. So that's something that I would have to dive a little deeper into. But the truth is, if they want to do business in our state and they want to sell books, they need to really be in line with our standards and with the law.
This is the Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. We're talking with Florida's new education commissioner, Manny Diaz.
Let's talk about the parental rights in education law, which restricts classroom discussions about gender identity and sexual orientation. It requires the state, your department, the Department of Education, to update state standards for what is age appropriate for these discussions by June of 2023. How will you go about defining what is age appropriate under this law?
Well, like we do in education all the time, I think there is a pedagogy and there is a timeline by which not only standards but concepts student learn at what age, and those are you know, things that have been studied and come up with child psychologists and human development and all those things. We will use our professionals at the department to assure that the materials are not only in line with the concepts that are covered in the standards, which is number one, and number two, that you're not using a middle school book for a third grader. You know, the material needs to be covered within the realm of topics and concepts that is being introduced to those students at that age. We should constantly be in review of that and always have things that are age appropriate, regardless of the topic.
As you know, opponents of this piece of legislation have focused on concerns regarding LGBTQ plus population. How does heterosexuality figure into this work toward defining age appropriateness?
It should all be the same. I mean, age appropriate is age appropriate regardless of the topic.
Does the law apply to charter schools as well?
The law should apply to charter schools because the materials.
But does it?
I'm not clear on that. There was discussions back and forth, but I need to investigate if it specifically applies to charter schools, but they're public schools. So I'm assuming that the content that's covered in those areas should be in line with the public school curriculum.
Why is there a question, even in your mind as a legislator, whether or not this law that you voted on applies to public charter schools? Why wasn't that clear during the debate and conversation, I guess?
I would say going back now to all the number of pieces of legislation that we passed, that if you ask me bits and pieces of it right now, going back and trying to remember what's each one of those bills in totality is difficult. So having the details of that, that's something that I want to confirm before I answer you, because I actually, you know, again, we went through, that wasn't my bill. I did vote on it, but it wasn't my bill. And most of the content of the bill and the discussion was around the content and not where the application was.
As the incoming education commissioner in Florida, do you think that this law, the parental rights in education law, should apply to all schools receiving public funds?
I think it should apply to the public schools, especially those that receive dollars for their instructional materials and what's covered and follow the state standards.
Would that include religious schools taking state vouchers, state scholarships?
Religious schools and private schools under the vouchers do not fall under the state standards or the curriculum, so it wouldn't apply there. And there, a parent, you know, is obviously making the decision of the school they're taking their child, choosing them to putting them in any specific program. And again, this bill's titled Parental Rights, so it's a parent's choice to make a decision like that.
But couldn't that scholarship money be used for instructional materials in those religious schools?
Scholarship funds are used for tuition. Obviously, school has to function and then buy materials. But again, I go back to the fact that this is a topic where the parent is making a decision of which program they're putting them in. And there's also, you know, if you get into areas where you're violating health, welfare, and safety of the student, then the department does have the right to step in to schools that receive vouchers because they are under the supervision of the department.
Let's talk about the Individual Freedom Act, the so-called Stop Woke Act that Governor DeSantis first proposed back in December. This bans a student from being instructed to feel, quote, guilt, anguish, or other forms of psychological distress for actions in which he or she played no part. What does that, as the incoming education commissioner, what does that phrase, guilt or anguish, psychological distress for actions, mean to you?
No. What it directly means to me and what is written in the bill is the imposition of guilt, anguish for something that the student wasn't involved in. In other words, blaming someone for something that happened, you know, 150 years ago when it wasn't them and they weren't there just because of the color of their skin or their background or what country they came from. That is what it means. You know, if somebody feels guilty because of a conversation, that's not covered under the law, which is what's been talked about. But the truth is, it's the prohibition of being imposing the guilt or forcing someone to take the guilt and action with the threat that their grade would be affected in a negative manner if they don't step up and accept it.
So as a legal concept, it's not just feeling of guilt or anguish, but there's some kind of evidence necessary that an instructor imposed that feeling toward a student.
That is correct. That is correct. And it goes into a statute that already exists that has a cause of action that has to have evidence that you need to be able to prove it in order for them to be actioned. Obviously, there are school there are complaints on teachers and on materials that are taught every day in our schools. And school districts have a process for dealing with those. It goes through the teacher first and the administrator. Then, you know, if it gets above that, if it's system wide, it goes to the school board. But again, there is a process and there is due process. So this is not something that happens frivolously. It's in order for it to be actually upheld, has to have evidence.
As a legislator, Senator Diaz, your full-time job has been as an administrator for a college owned by a company that owns for-profit charter schools. Now, as education commissioner, will you continue in that role?
No, the education commissioner position is a full-time role, and I will be committed to it full-time. I will no longer be employed at the private nonprofit college, and my dedication full-time will be to the students and the parents of the great state of Florida.
Your predecessor, Richard Corcoran, I think it's fair to say, had a combative relationship with some school districts and school boards during the pandemic. What do you see as your role as education commissioner?
Look, I served with Richard Corcoran in the Florida House. I think he did a great job as commissioner as well. Everybody has their own style. And if you look back at the 10 years of my legislative career, I have a style that is not as combative. I put my health down and go to work. That doesn't mean that I don't have the same intensity or the same drive or the same beliefs and philosophy. It just means that we have different styles when we go about it. I look to have, as Richard often didn't, I look to have open doors and conversations with teachers, teachers unions, stakeholders, parents, whoever, to listen to their concerns, because that's how we make our system better. But at the same time, I have a job to do to implement the law and also to make sure that I look out for all of Florida students. And so I will do that, and we will continue to push forward with the governor's vision and making sure that our state continues to have great educational opportunities for our students.
Given your professional interest and career in charter schools, your role as a regulator and lawmaker, now your role as commissioner, what's your definition of public education in Florida?
My definition of public education is what I think the founders and that generation looked at, is in order to have a productive citizenry who is educated and are able to uphold our republic, it is to provide that education. Where I think I differ with some people is that some people think public education only means education by your public district school. And I believe that it's a menu of options, whether it be through your district public schools and those programs and improving and expanding those, whether it be our public charter schools, or whether it be here in the state of Florida, our different scholarship programs. I think all of it is part of our public education system. We don't push for any one of them. It's parents' decision to make that best decision for each individual child. And each individual child is different. So I think the whole landscape is public education. We should be concerned for all of it.
Senator Manny Diaz, the new education commissioner in the state of Florida. Commissioner Diaz, thank you so much for spending the time with us here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Still to come, Florida's new election fraud patrol. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
In Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. This week, Governor Ron DeSantis signed off on a new election police force for Florida. DeSantis says the additional changes would give Floridians more confidence about the voting process.
We just want to make sure whatever laws are on the books, that those laws are enforced, and that if people know that we're going to enforce the law, I think everyone will be very happy.
However, critics say this new election police unit for the state is unnecessary and, they charge, politically motivated. For more on this, we spoke with Cecile Schoon, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Cecile Schoon, good to be with you. Thanks for joining the Florida Roundup.
My pleasure.
So the League of Women Voters of Florida has come out with heavy criticism against the state's new election police unit. You say it's unnecessary. Why is that?
Well, when the legislators who proposed this bill, this law, when they were asked, you know, was there evidence of significant fraud or anything that was going on that you're unhappy about with the elections, they all said no. The elections were wonderful, and the governor said so. Immediately after the elections, our Secretary of State, Lee, who's over the Division of Elections, said that also. I mean, I was proud. I think every Floridian, we've had so many problems when, you know, the government says we got our results right away. We had a lot of early voting. Everything went well. You took that to heart. So it was a real right turn out of the blue, basically coming from national political pressure to, you know, say that we needed election police, because in Florida, there was no need.
Among the provisions of this law, some seem fairly anodyne. One piece of it calls for requiring election supervisors to clean up voter rolls annually, you know, checking the status of people who've died or who are inactive or who may have moved. Others are more controversial. This would establish a 25-person Office of Election Crimes and Security to look into voting irregularities or illegalities. It would ban ranked choice voting statewide, which is catching on in other states. It would make ballot harvesting a felony. That's the practice of a person or organization collecting completed mail ballots from other people and delivering them. What about some of these aspects of the law? And critics such as your organization have described this as creating a chilling effect on access to the ballot. Can you explain why you feel strongly about this?
Sure. As supervisors of elections doing maintenance of the rolls, that's no problem. That's something that is a practical thing that the league has no problem with. And I believe the supervisors of elections also said, yeah, we could do better there. So that is not something the league is complaining about. The issue of ballot harvesting, that's just like a really kind of negative word. What was going on in the community is that many times churches and places of worship, especially in the Black community, what happens is in my church, there would be designated people who would drive around and pick up people from either their homes or nursing homes and bring them to church, because they're the mothers and the grandmothers of the church and the grandfathers, and we want our elderly with us at this time. And so it's difficult for them to get around. Sometimes people would buy their groceries. So as part of that, I heard in my own hearing, the pastor would say, okay, on Wednesday, everyone, you know, look at your ballot and everything and bring it in on Sunday. And then they would bring it to church and someone would take it in for them. Nobody was getting paid. It was somebody we knew. And so this thing that so-called ballot harvesting is hurting that community effort of known people helping people that they know and love who need help. So that's hurtful, and that's a practice that was not uncommon in many of the Black churches where we know all of the congregants. There are people that, you know, we take care of. So there's a concern that because the investigators, they're going to respond to whatever's called in, that this opens the door for targeting and frightening many groups.
Cecile, what about the criticism of this law that has been made not only by the League of Women Voters of Florida, but other opponents of this measure? They see this move by the governor as an effort to appeal to GOP primary base voters who believe a lie. They believe that former President Donald Trump somehow had the 2020 election stolen from him. He alleged fraud in several swing states No evidence of fraud was ever proven in court. In fact, dozens of cases were thrown out of court. And so what about the notion that a false belief among many voters out there is driving Florida policy?
That's very, very concerning. And there seems to be, when pressed, there's a leadership in the Republican Party that has agreed that President Biden won the election fair and square, but they are not coming forward and saying it aggressively and openly. They're terrified of being turned against by their base. And that's just a lack of courage and a lack of following the truth. And in the state of Florida, Floridians in particular, they need to stop and think about what's going on. In Florida, former President Trump won the state. So to say, oh my gosh, he was stolen and we need new laws in Florida is completely illogical. The individual that many of these baseline voters wanted won, and won with a fairly decent margin. So not only was there no proof, there was no evidence of any fraud in Florida, which all of the supervisors of elections agreed with, the Division of Elections, the governor agreed with. So we have that. And on top of it, the person that many of these people who think there's something stolen, your candidate won. So you don't have to turn around and do everything that you hear happening in other states. There is no basis, no facts, and the person that you wanted to win won. No fraud, no steal, nothing. There was none across the nation. We know that. But certainly Floridians, if they just want to look at what happened in our state, since we're spending money from our state coffers, they should look at what happened in Florida. And if they just stop for a moment, they would understand that this is ridiculous and a waste of money.
Cecile Schoon, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, thanks for joining us. We did invite Republican sponsors of the new election police unit to appear on the Florida Roundup and didn't hear back.
Well, the Sunshine State is no longer going to participate in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Now, this decision is drawing alarm from doctors and child welfare agencies across the state. This survey is administered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's a unique source of data monitoring youth health risk behaviors and is used to help set policy to protect children and young people.
We'll go to your calls on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey in a moment. The number to join us, 305-995-1800. Tweet us your questions at Florida Roundup. But first, let's speak with Dr. Mobeen Rathore, professor and associate chair of the Department of Pediatrics at UF Health Jax. He's also past president of the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Rathore, good to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning, panel.
So why are doctors and child welfare advocates so concerned about this decision that the state is no longer participating in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey?
Well, you know, it's important to understand what this is first and foremost. You know, this is a surveillance system that was launched by the CDC in 1990 to monitor many of the health risks, behavior that can lead to disease and death, social problems. So this is a national system, surveillance system, which many states, territories, and tribal systems participate. And was initiated to provide data on the prevalence and co-occurrence of primary and health, behavioral health sort of risk factors, including unintentional injuries, violence, sexual behavior, alcohol and drug use, tobacco use, you know, unhealthy dietary behavior, mental health issues, inadequate exercise, activity, all of those. So you can see why this is so important, because, you know, especially in this day and time, as families across the state continue to experience hardships amid the pandemic, this information is key for the planners, for the legislators, for policymakers, and the state's withdrawal. You know, this comes at a time when it is more important than ever to have this sort of a data for the health and well-being of our young people, kids who go to school, and it's, you know, the Department of Children's Families, for example, they use the YRBS data to monitor suicide prevention, anxiety that, as you know, is at its highest level for a long time in the pandemic and continues to rise. Suicide prevention is the third leading cause of death among young people. Even the opioid crisis, and that continues to be escalating even through the pandemic, and the opioid deaths are increasing. So I think these allow us to propose increased allocations towards services and from mental health, well-being, physical health-being, prevention services. So there are so many things. And by the way, it's not just physicians who are opposed for the state not participating in this and are concerned about it, which is anybody who cares for children and is a child advocate.
So from what I hear you saying, Dr. Rathore, this is the worst possible time, in your view, to stop gathering this data. Do you consider youth in Florida and in the nation to be at a particularly vulnerable time in history in terms of all of the stressors that they're under?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as I said, this is the worst time one could pick to do this. I mean, it would be bad at any time, frankly, because if we don't have the right data, it is difficult for planning the appropriate service for youth. And there's so much going on in the pandemic. You know, our hospitals have been filled with youth with mental health problems. You know, anxiety levels are going up, suicide, and we're going back to school, talking about violence, tobacco. I mean, We need this information, which is sort of being the bulwark of how we plan our services for our youth and children. And it's been it's not like it's a well-tested and scientifically valid system. It's a surveillance system which allows us. Here's the other thing: we have information to county level, so the health county school systems, health departments, they can work together, and they can also compare what's happening in your area, in your region, in your school district, in your state, with the others, and see what, you know, how you're faring. So I think, again, this is exactly the time. I mean, although this started back in 1990s, it is perfectly built for the current time for us to have a better plan for serving our youth.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Do we know why the state has decided to no longer participate in this public health survey?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that. I mean, we can all speculate why it is. I think one of the things that, you know, this program does, it also tells us about the services and the challenges our LGBTQ youth are facing. You know, this is also something that helps us for homeless youth. I mean, the sexual behavior. I mean, if you want to not know about things and act like an ostrich, this is perfect not to do the survey. But I don't know really the reason, because it's not like it's something bad or it's impending on somebody. It's a voluntary survey, by the way. Youth 9th to 12th grade can opt out of it if they want to. The parents can opt out if they want to. It's a voluntary survey, so nobody's being forced to do it.
Now, the Florida Department of Health also recently released guidelines opposing all forms of gender-affirming care for the treatment of youth gender dysphoria, including social affirmation and gender transition. You mentioned the LGBTQ population among youth, and you survey this vulnerable group, or at least the state did until now, via the survey. So how does that decision from the state health department interact, in your view, with the decision to stop participating in the youth risk behavior survey?
Well, that's a terrible decision just on its own. It doesn't need anything else to be said on that one. Certainly it'll impact, because if we don't know how to serve this population, it's going to be even worse. But again, that's an issue that all healthcare advocates, physicians, and the Florida chapter, we are opposed to that. We are opposed to legislators to tell us how we take care of our patients. We cannot have the legislators in our patient rooms, in our physician-patient relationship. You know, we have professional societies who look at this. The American Academy of Pediatrics has guidelines. The Endocrine Society has guidelines. I mean, these are folks who look at all science and all evidence. And it's critically important that not just this, but any service that we provide to our patients is based on science and evidence. Melissa, as you know, I'm a big fan of science and evidence, and we need to make sure that we don't let somebody sitting in Tallahassee tell somebody in Orlando how they take care of their patient. And these are people, most of them, there are a few healthcare people in the register, have really no idea what this is about. I mean, I'm a physician. I've been practicing for more than 31 years. I'm not an expert in that. I have to look at the experts myself who are expert in transgender issues and ask for their guidance.
Dr. Rethor, is it hyperbolic to say, or is it fair to say, that Florida's decision to withdraw from this survey is endangering kids' lives in Florida?
Yes. Yes.
You believe that not gathering this data will put kids at risk of harm or death?
It would, because if we cannot find out what's the degree of mental health issues, what's the degree of suicide activity or ideation, or how can we do suicide prevention? How can we do tobacco prevention if you're not understanding what is happening? What sexual behavior? You know, Florida is having a higher number of syphilis and other sexually transmitted diseases, and not knowing what children's sexual behaviors are, what sexual mental health issues are, what the suicide prevention issues are, what injury and violence prevention issues are. I can go on and on, and you can surmise from that. If we don't have that information, how do we impact to make sure that the bad things don't happen to these children because of this? So I think, yes, we are going to put children's health at risk. We are going to put children's life at risk. And I think that's why people are concerned.
We are talking about the recent decision by the state of Florida to opt out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which asks questions to young people throughout the state of Florida and elsewhere in the United States regarding a number of different behaviors. We'd like to hear from you. 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. Students, parents, grandparents, we'd love to hear from you. 305-995-1800. As the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for supporting public broadcasting in your community. In Miami, I'm Tom Hudson.
In Jacksonville, I'm Melissa Ross. We're talking right now about Florida deciding to no longer participate in the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. The CDC administers this nationwide. Health professionals say it's critical to protecting kids on a range of issues. What are your questions? 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Getting some tweets already on the show about this, expressing concern about the withdrawal. Let's continue now with Dr. Mobeen Rathor, who's been filling us in on this. Dr. Rathor, high school participation in this survey is higher than middle school. Is that representative, the survey results that in the past have been collected?
Well, it is representative of kids. Yes, for high school is more numbers, but it does represent. Remember, this is a nationwide survey, so the trends are nationwide. And I think this is the sort of a survey that even with, that's the, by the way, this is the best information we have to plan, and this is the information that is information gathered for them is used to develop and implement programs and shape public policy and support public health and ensure that, you know, youth are healthy and they're ready to succeed. This is our future, and I think it's important that the state of Florida, the state agencies reconfirm a commitment and support this great resource that is used by every other state. It is not something that is, we are trying to gather some personal information. It's anonymized anyways, and it provides data on trends that underlie, for example, urgency to attending risk behaviors. And we want to have that. It allows the examination of data in subgroups that in order we can tailor our interventions and supports the students who need it most.
You and other doctors, it's my understanding, are mobilizing to try to get the state to change its mind on this. Is that right?
Well, we are. We are writing about it. We are trying to present science, and we are trying to present evidence that this is important. By the way, it's not just the doctors. I keep repeating that child advocates are very concerned. Doctors is a one group, but there are whole large group of Floridians who serve children for suicide prevention, for mental health issues, for sexual risk behavior issues, for teaching. And so I think the school should, because the school districts and school administrators and teachers are concerned. I know I'm a physician, that's why I probably are addressing that, but it is much wider group of child advocates than just physicians who are trying to hopefully convince the state to see the light, do the right thing by our children, and continue participating in this survey.
Doctor, we want to hear from some Floridians now about this survey and Florida's decision, the state decision, to opt out of the Centers for Disease Control Youth Risk Behavior Survey. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Donna is listening and joining us from Hollywood. Go ahead, Donna. You're on the radio.
Oh, yes. Hello. I was listening to your wonderful program, and my comment is that turning away from education and learning and understanding, accepting other human beings that might not be exactly like us is a good thing. And turning away from the light and staying in ignorance, going back to the cave, is not an option. And human beings are like flowers in a garden. We're all colors, all sizes, all shapes, and we look different, but we're really all the same.
Donna, I appreciate the imagery. Thanks for joining the conversation there from Hollywood. Chris is listening in Wesley Chapel. Chris, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes, hi. I had a question for the doctor. Doctor, are there any questions in that survey that you might feel that if they were being asked of your children, that would be somewhat invasive? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Fair enough. Doctor, go ahead.
Yeah, that's an important question. Students don't have to answer all the questions also. If you're a student, first of all, it's anonymous, so you will never get back to you. But if a student feels that they don't want to answer a question, they don't have to. I mean, that's the beauty of this. It's a voluntary. So whether I feel if a question is appropriate or not appropriate for my child or somebody else who's appropriate their child, if the child doesn't feel like they want to answer it, they don't have to. So I'm not very concerned about that. It's not like somebody's looking over my shoulder and say, you better answer this question, man. That's not what's happening.
Doctor, one of the questions asks about emotional health. It asks if a student or a young person felt sad or hopeless almost every day for two or more weeks, so that they stopped doing usual activities. Excuse me. In 2019, 34% of Floridian youth said yes to this. That's a 6% increase from 2017. And of course, this doesn't capture the pandemic years. Without that question being asked, in the years ahead, what potentially could be missed? What do mental health experts, advocates, what do youth advocates need to be watching?
Well, that's a very important and very critical statistic. Let me add to that. There was a 5% increase in the same period of time for a youth who were seriously considering suicide. So if we don't know where our youth are with their mental in this, what we refer to as often as the mental health domain, if we don't know where are they in that domain, how are we going to tailor services for our youth? How are we going to allocate resources? How are we going to make sure there's enough information for policymakers to make a policy, for the people on the ground implement those policies, and for the state to fund those programs? I think. And as you're right, just the mental health domain, I suspect if they did the survey, they'll find it's much worse. There is going to be the survey is done every other year, so there's going to be data coming out very soon, subsequent to the last one, I think was 2019. So I think the 2021 data should be coming soon. So there'll be some help for this, but we are nowhere close to out of this pandemic. And I think there is another part to it we need to focus on. As kids come back to school more and more, it's normalized, there are going to be other stresses that they're going to face.
That they're going to face. And so, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Lots of tweets. Terry tweets the show, the increasing youth suicide rate alone would be justification for saving any program aimed at helping youth. How caring can officials be if they discontinue participation? Let's go to Sean in Tampa. He's on the line. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. I listen to you guys all the time.
Thank you.
So I am the parent of an LGBTQ plus child, and I think that the most important part from my perspective is that I'll just be super blunt. This is not an area where we should be asking questions, why are people doing what they're doing? This is a very clear and very real attack with real effect that causes damage to a very vulnerable group of people that I, as a parent, don't entirely know what I'm doing or what I should be doing, how all that works. And then someone's going to come out of left field, interject themselves into that, and cause damage by removing this information that's very helpful to providing services for people who need it, such as my child. And I just want to know, why do we keep asking, why are they doing this? Why are they doing this? This is very clear why this is happening. This is an aggressive movement by a Republican, far-right-leaning administrator to damage and criminalize LGBTQ plus-ness, period.
Sean, thanks for your opinion on that. Let's be clear, we still do not have an explanation. We will seek to get one about this decision. But Dr. Rathore, certainly parents feel quite strongly about this, as we've heard from callers. Is the refusal to participate an attack, as that caller believes, on vulnerable youth populations?
So let me share with you one other statistic. You know, for students who consider themselves as gay or lesbian or in the LGBTQ community, if that's what they consider, their seriously considering suicide, the numbers were double of the general. So it's what, more than 30% of them. So just that one number. So if we cannot tailor these services specific, to these LGBTQ children, that's going to be dangerous. You know, data clearly underscore that we need to have gender-specific programming and as well support services for not only the LGBTQ population, but the other vulnerable population, the homeless children. I mean, that's one other group that we, they're about, they probably estimate 2 million homeless children who go to school, and there are a whole bunch of homeless school-age children who don't even go to school. So I think it does place those children who are more vulnerable. All children are vulnerable. Let's not forget about that. Okay,
yeah.
That's a vulnerable population. But within that vulnerable population, there are groups that are even higher vulnerability: LGBTQ, homeless, those with mental health issues. I think we have to tailor our services to those specific group of our children.
Doctor, just about 20 seconds here. Could the survey be distributed in Florida without the state government okay?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think so, because it is my understanding that the CDC can only come to a state if the government invites them. There's some sort of a federal law or whatever. They cannot come in without the state government's permission, if you will.
Dr. Rathore, thank you for sharing your time and your expertise with us and the Florida Roundup. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Mobeen Rathore, Professor, Associate Chair of the Department of Pediatrics at UF Jacksonville, past President of the Florida Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Now, if you or anyone you know is struggling with suicide, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. 800-273-8255.
That's our show. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Natu Chwe are producers. Catherine Hobbs is associate producer.
WLRN's Director of Radio Operations and our program's Technical Director is Peter Maritz. Engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres.
Alyssa Ramos answered the phones this week. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday.